standing behind me in the kitchen, telling me I am not working fast enough. But even though I am shaping loaves and slipping them into the oven so quickly that I have blisters on my fingers and blood baked into the dough, every time I take out a finished loaf, there are only bones, bleached white as the sails of a ship. "It's about time," Mary scolds, and before I can stop her, she picks one up with chopsticks and bites down hard, breaking all of her teeth into tiny pearls that fall to the floor and roll beneath my shoes. I am in such a deep sleep, in fact, that even though I reach for the receiver and say hello, I drop it and it rolls underneath my bed. "Sorry," I say, after I retrieve it. "Hello? Sage Singer?" "Yes, that's me. This is Leo Stein." I sit up in bed, suddenly awake. "I'm sorry."
"You said that already. Did I? You sound like I woke you up."
"Well, yeah."
"Then I'm the one who should be apologizing. I figured since it was 11 o'clock...
"I'm a baker," I interrupt. "I work at night and sleep during the day."
"You can call me back at a more convenient time."
"Just tell me," I say. "What did you find out?"
"Nothing," Leo Stein replies. "There are absolutely no records in the SS membership registry for Joseph Weber."
"Then there's been a mistake. Did you try spelling it differently?"
"My historian is very thorough, Ms. Singer. I'm sorry, but I think you might have misunderstood what he was telling you."
"I didn't." I push my hair out of my face. "You're the one who said the records aren't complete. Isn't it possible that you just haven't found the right one yet?"
"It's possible, but without that, we really can't do anything else."
"Will you keep looking?"
I can hear the hesitation in his voice, the understanding that I am asking him to find an invisible needle in a haystack. "I don't know how to stop," Leo says. "We'll run checks in two Berlin record centers and our own databases, but the bottom line is, if there's no valid information to run with..."
"Give me till lunchtime," I beg.
In the end, it is the way I met Joseph, at a grief group, that makes me wonder if Leo Stein is right, if Joseph is lying. After all, he lived with Marta for 52 years. That's a damn long time to keep a secret. It is pouring when I reach his house, and I don't have an umbrella. I'm drenched after running to the covered porch, where Eva barks for nearly half a minute before Joseph comes to the door. I am seeing double, not a blurriness of vision, but a superimposition of this old man with a younger, stronger one dressed in the uniform of the soldiers I have seen on YouTube.
"Your wife," I say. "Did she know you're a Nazi?"
Joseph opens the door wider. "Come in. This is not a conversation for the street." I follow him into his living room, where the chess game we were playing days earlier remains, unicorns and dragons frozen at my last move. "I never told her," Joseph admits.
"That's impossible. She would have wanted to know where you were during the war."
"I said I was sent by my parents to study at university in England. Marta never questioned it. You would be surprised at the lengths you would go to believe the best about someone if you truly love him," Joseph says. That, of course, makes me think of Adam.
"It must be hard, Joseph," I say coolly, "to not get tangled up in your lies." My words land like blows. Joseph shrinks back in his chair.
"This is the reason I told you the truth."
"But you didn't, did you?"
"What do you mean?" I can't very well tell him that the reason I know he's been lying is that a Nazi hunter from the Department of Justice checked out his false story. It just doesn't add up. A wife who never stumbled over the truth, not in 52 years... A history of being a monster without any proof? Of course, the biggest inconsistency of all is why, after over 65 years of keeping a secret, you'd blow your own cover. "I told you. I want to die," Why now?
Because I have no one to live for, Joseph says. Marta was an angel. She saw good in me when I couldn't even look in a mirror. I so badly wanted to be the man she thought she had married that I became him. If she knew what I had done.
She would have killed you?
No, Joseph says. She would have killed herself. I did not care about what happened to me, but I couldn't stand thinking of what it would be like for her to know she had been touched by hands that would never truly be clean.
He looks at me.
I know she is in heaven now. I promised myself that I would be who she wanted me to be until she was gone. But now that this is the case, I have come to you.
Joseph folds his hands between his knees.
Dare I hope this means you are considering my request?
He speaks formally, as if he has asked me to dance with him at a mixer. As if this is a business proposition. But I string him along. You understand how selfish you're being, right? You want me to risk getting arrested. Basically, I give up the rest of my life just so you can leave yours.
This is not the case. No one is going to think twice if an old man turns up dead.
Murder isn't legal, in case you've forgotten in the past 68 years.
Ah, but you see, this is why I have been waiting for someone like you. If you do it, it's not murder, it is mercy.
He meets my gaze.
You see, before you help me die, Sage, I need one more favor from you. I ask you to forgive me first.
Forgive you?
For the things I did back then.
I am not the one you should be asking forgiveness from.
No, he agrees, but they are all dead.
Slowly, the cogs turn until the picture lines up clearly for me. Now I see why he turned to me for his grand confession. Joseph does not know about my grandmother. However, I am the closest thing to a Jew he can find in this town. It is, I realize, like the victim's family in a death row case. Do they have the right to seek justice? My great-grandparents had died at the hands of Nazis. Did that make me, by proxy, the next best thing? I hear Leo's voice, an echo in my mind. I don't know how to stop. Is his work vengeance or justice? There is the finest line between the two, and when I try to focus on it, it becomes less and less clear. Repentance might bring peace to the killer, but what about the ones who've been killed? I may not consider myself a Jew, but do I still have responsibility to the relatives of mine who were religious and who were murdered for it? Joseph confided in me because he considers me a friend, because he trusts me. But if Joseph's claims are legitimate, the man I befriended and trusted is a shadow puppet, a figment of the imagination, a man who has deceived thousands of people. It makes me feel dirty, as if I should have been a stronger judge of character. In that moment, I make myself a promise. I will find out if Joseph Weber was an SS soldier. Yet if he does turn out to be a Nazi, I will not kill him the way he wants. Instead, I will betray him the way he betrayed others. I will pump him for information and feed it back to Leo Stein, so Joseph will die somewhere in a prison cell. But he doesn't have to know that. I can't forgive you, I say evenly, if I don't know what you did. Before I agree to anything, you're going to have to give me some actual proof of your past. The relief that floods Joseph's features is palpable, almost painful. His eyes fill with tears.
The photograph
means nothing. For all I know, it's not even you, or it came from eBay.
I understand.
Joseph looks up at me.
So, the first thing you will need to know, he says, is my real name.
If Joseph thinks it is strange when I jump up moments later and ask to use his bathroom, he doesn't say so. Instead, he directs me down the hall to a small powder room that has wallpaper blooming with cabbage roses and a little dish of decorative soap still in their plastic wrap. I run the water in the sink and then take my cell phone out of my pocket. Leo Stein answers on the first ring. His name isn't Joseph Weber, I say breathlessly.
Hello?
It's me, Sage Singer.
Why are you whispering?
Because I'm hiding in Joseph's bathroom, I say.
I thought his name wasn't Joseph.
It's not. It's Rainer Hartmann, with two N's at the end. And I have a birth date for him, too, April 20th, 1918.
Same as the Führer, he had said.
That would make him 95, Leo says, doing the math. I thought you said it's never too late to go after them.
It's not. 95 is better than dead. But how do you know he's telling you the truth?
I don't, I say, but you will. Stick it in a database and see what happens.
It's not quite that easy.
It can't be that hard. Where's your historian? Ask her to do it.
Ms. Singer.
Look, I'm hiding in an old man's bathroom. You told me that with a name and a birth date, records are easier to find.
He sighs. Let me see what I can do. While I am waiting, I flush the toilet. Twice. I am sure that Joseph or Rainer or whatever he wants to be called now is wondering if I've fallen in. Maybe he thinks I'm taking a sponge bath in the sink. After about 10 minutes, I hear Leo's voice.
Rainer Hartmann was a member of the Nazi Party, he says.
I feel oddly euphoric, knowing that there's been a hit, and also leaden, because it means that the man on the other side of that door was involved in mass murders. I let out the breath I've been holding. So I was right.
Just because his name turned up in the Berlin Document Center doesn't mean he's a legal slam dunk. Leo says, this is just the beginning.
What happens next?
That depends, Leo replies. What more can you find out?
It felt like a blade along the side of my neck. I heard the rip of my own skin, felt the blood, sticky and hot, dripping down my chest. Again, he dove toward me, snapping my vocal cords. All I could do was wait for the razor of his teeth, know that it was coming again. I had heard the stories of Upjor who rose from the dead and ate through their linen shrouds in search of the blood that would sustain them, because they no longer had any of their own. They were insatiable. I had heard the stories, and now I knew they were true. This was no piercing of fangs, no draining. He gorged on me and brought me to the edge of death, the brink he skated on for eternity. So this was what hell was like, a slow, silent scream. No strength to move, no voice to speak, just my other senses heightened, touch and smell and sound as he shredded my flesh. He banged my head against the ground once, twice. My eyes rolled back in. Darkness dropped like a guillotine. Suddenly I bolted upright. I was bathed in sweat, my cheek dusty with flour where I had fallen asleep waiting for the dough to rise. But that banging was still in my head. I grabbed for my throat, relieved to find it smooth and whole, and heard it again. Someone was knocking on the door of the cottage. The man with the golden eyes was standing at the door, silhouetted by the moon.
I could bake for you, he said.
His voice was deep, soft, accented. I wondered where he had come from. I was still partly in a dream state. I didn't understand.
My name is Alexander Lubov, he told me. I've seen you in the village. I know about your father.
He looked over my shoulder at the baguettes couched in linen, lined up like waiting soldiers.
During the day I have to watch my brother. He isn't right in the head, and he'll harm himself if he's left alone. But I have to find work, too. Work I can do at night when he's asleep.
When will you sleep? I asked, the first question to pierce like an arrow through the fog of my mind. He smiled, and just like that, I couldn't breathe.
Who says that I do?
I can't pay you.
I'll take what you can give, he replied.
I thought of how tired I was. I thought of what my father would say if I let a stranger into his bakery. I thought of Damien and Baruch Beiler and what they each wanted from me. It is said that you're safer with the devil you know than with the devil you don't. And I knew nothing about Alexander Lubov. So why would I agree to his proposal?
Because, he said, as if he could read my mind, you need me.
Joseph. I will not answer to the other name. That person, he is someone I like to think I have never been. But this isn't true. Inside each of us is a monster. Inside each of us is a saint. The real question is which one we nurture the most. Which one will smite the other? To understand what I became, you must know where I came from. My family, we lived in Wevelsburg, which was part of the city of Büren in the district of Paderborn. My father was a machinist by trade, and my mother kept house. My earliest memory is of my father and mother fighting over money. After the First Great War, inflation spiraled out of control. Their savings, which they had diligently put away for years, were suddenly worth nothing. My father had just cashed in a 10-year insurance policy, and the proceeds did not even cover the cost of a newspaper. A cup of coffee was 5,000 marks, a loaf of bread, 200 billion marks. As a boy, I remember running with my mother to meet my father on payday, and then began the mad rush to the shops to purchase goods. Often the shops had run out. Then my brother, Franz, and I would be sent at twilight into the fields of farmers who lived outside of Wevelsburg to steal apples from the trees and potatoes from the ground. Not everyone suffered, of course. Some had invested in gold early on. Some speculated in fabric or meat or soap or produce. But most middle-class Germans, like my family, were ruined. The Weimar Republic, shiny and new after the war, was a disaster. My parents had done everything right, worked hard, saved well. And to what end? Election after election, no one seemed to have the answer. The reason I tell you this is that everyone always asks, how could Nazis come to power? How could Hitler have had such free rein? Well, I tell you. Desperate people often do things that they normally would not do. If you went to the doctor and he said you had a terminal disease, you'd probably walk out of that office feeling pretty low. Yet if you shared this news with friends, and one told you, you know, I had a friend who was diagnosed with that too, and Dr. X cured him right away. Well, maybe he's the biggest quack. Maybe he charges $2 million for a consultation. But I bet you'd still be on the phone to him immediately. No matter how educated you are, no matter how irrational it seems, you will follow a glimmer of hope. The National Socialist German Workers' Party. It was that ray of light. Nothing else was working to fix Germany. So why not try this? They promised to get people back to work, to get rid of the Treaty of Versailles, to regain the territory we'd lost in the war, to put Germany back in its rightful place. When I was 5 years old, Hitler tried to take over the government at a beer hall, the Munich Putsch, and failed miserably by most accounts. But he learned that the way to lead a revolution was not violently, but legally. And at his trial in 1924, every word Hitler spoke was reported in the German newspapers, the National Socialist Party's first propaganda onslaught. You will notice I say nothing about the Jews. That is because most of us didn't know a single Jew. Out of 60 million Germans, only 500,000 were Jews, and even those would have called themselves Germans, not Jews. But anti-Semitism was alive and well in Germany long before Hitler became powerful. It was part of what we were taught in church, how 2,000 years ago the Jews had killed our Lord. It was evident in the way we viewed Jews. Good investors, who seemed to have money in a bad economy when no one else had any. Selling the idea that the Jews were to blame for all of Germany's problems was just not that difficult. Any military man will tell you that the way to pull a divided group together is to give them a common enemy. This is what Hitler did when he came to power in 1933 as Chancellor. He threaded this philosophy through the Nazi Party, directing his diatribes against those who leaned left politically. Yet the Nazis pointed out the linkage between Jews and the left, Jews and crime, Jews and unpatriotic behavior. If people hated Jews already for religious reasons or economic reasons, giving them another reason to hate them was not really going to be difficult. So when Hitler said that the biggest threat to the German state was an attack on the purity of the German people, and so her uniqueness must be guarded at all costs, well, it gave us something to be proud of again. The threat of Jews was in the mathematics. They would mingle with ethnic Germans in order to raise their own status, and in doing so would bring down Germany's dominance. We Germans needed Lebensraum, living space, to be a great nation. Without room to expand, there was little choice. You went to war to conquer territory, and you got rid of the people who were a threat to Germany, or who weren't ethnic Germans like you. By 1935, when I was already a young man, Germany had left the League of Nations. Hitler announced that Germany would be rebuilding its army, which had been forbidden after the First Great War. Of course, had any other country, France, England, stepped in and stopped him, what happened might not have happened. But who wanted to go back to war that quickly? It was easier just to rationalize what was happening, to say he was only taking back what had once belonged to Germany. And in the meantime, in my country, there were jobs again. Factories for munitions and guns and planes. People were not making as much money as they used to, and they were working longer hours, but they were able to support their families. By 1939, the German Lebensraum extended through the Saar, the Rhineland, Austria, the Sudetenland, and the Czechlands. And finally, when the Germans moved into Danzig, Poland, the English and French declared war. I will tell you a little bit about myself as a boy. My parents desperately wanted their children to have a better life than they had, and the answer they believed was in education. Surely people who had learned how to invest better would not have found themselves in such dire financial straits. Although I wasn't particularly bright, my parents wanted me to test into Gymnasium, the most academic education possible in Germany, the one whose graduates were university-bound. Of course, once there, I was always picking fights or clowning around, anything to hide the fact that I was in way over my head. My parents would be called into school weekly to see the headmaster, because I had failed another test, or because I'd come to blows with another student in the hall over a petty dispute. Luckily, my parents had another star to hitch their wagon to, my brother Franz. 2 years younger than me, Franz was studious, his head always buried in a book. He would scribble away in notebooks that he hid underneath his mattress, and that I would routinely steal to embarrass him. They were full of images I did not understand. A girl floating in an autumn pond, drowned because of a lost love. A deer, hollowed by hunger, picking through the snow for a single acorn. A fire that started in a soul and consumes a body, the bedding, the house surrounding it. He dreamed of studying poetry at Heidelberg, and my parents dreamed with him. And then, one day, things began to change. At Gymnasium, there was a contest to see which class could first get 100% participation in the Hitlerjugend. In 1934, joining the Hitler Youth was not mandatory yet, mind you. It was a social club, like your Boy Scouts, except we also swore allegiance to Hitler as his future soldiers. Under the guidance of adult leaders, we would meet after school and go camping on weekends. We wore uniforms that looked like those the SS wore, with a sig rune on the lapel. I, who at age 15 chafed at sitting at a desk, loved being outside. I excelled at the sports competitions. I had a reputation for being a bully, but that was not necessarily fair. Half of the time I was beating someone to a pulp because he had called Franz a sissy. I desperately wanted my class to win, not because I had any great allegiance to the Führer, but because the local leader of the HJ Kameradschaft was Herr Solomach, whose daughter Inge was the prettiest girl I had ever seen. She looked like an ice queen, with a silver blonde hair and a pale blue eyes, and she and her friends did not know I existed. This, I realized, was an opportunity to change that. For the competition, the teacher put everyone's names on the board, erasing those of the boys who had joined the HJ one by one. There were some who joined out of peer pressure, some who joined because their fathers said they had to. There were more than a dozen, however, who joined because I threatened to pound them in the schoolyard if they did not. My brother refused to join the Hitlerjugend. In his classroom, he and one other boy were the only ones who didn't. We all knew why Arthur Goldman did not join. He could not. When I asked Franz why he would align himself with a Jew, he said he didn't want his friend Arthur to feel like he was being left out. A few weeks later, Arthur stopped going to school and never came back. My father encouraged Franz to join the Hitlerjugend too, to make new friends. My mother made me promise to watch over him at our meetings. "Franz," she would say, "isn't strong like you." She worried about him camping out in the woods, getting sick too easily, not connecting with other boys. But for the first time in her life, she didn't have to worry about me. Because as it turned out, I was the poster child for the Hitlerjugend. We would hike and sing and do calisthenics. We learned how to line up in military formations. My favorite activity was Wehrsport. Military marching, bayonet drills, grenade throwing, trench digging, crawling through barbed wire. It made me feel like a soldier already. I had such enthusiasm for the Hitlerjugend that Herr Solomach told my father I would make a fine SS man one day. Was there any greater compliment? To find the strongest among us, there were also Mutproben, tests of courage. Even individuals who were afraid would be compelled to do what we were told to do, because otherwise the stigma of being a coward would cling to you like a stench. Our first test was climbing the rock wall at the castle, without any safety harness. Some of the older boys scrambled to be in the front of the line, but Franz held back, and I stayed with him, as per my mother's orders. When one of the boys fell and broke his leg, the training was aborted. A week later, as part of our tests of courage, Herr Solomach blindfolded a group of us. Franz, sitting next to me, held tightly on to my hand. "Rainer," he whispered, "I'm scared." "Just do what they say," I told him, "and it will be over soon." I had come to see a beautiful liberation in this way of sinking, which was, ironically, not having to sink for myself. At gymnasium, I wasn't clever enough to come up with the right answer. In Hitlerjugend, I was told the right answer, and as long as I parroted it back, I was considered a genius. We sat in this artificial dark, awaiting instructions. Herr Solenmark and some of the older boys patrolled in front of us. "If the Führer asks you to fight for Germany, what would you do?" "Fight!" we all yelled. "If the Führer asks you to die for Germany, what would you do?" "Die! What do you fear?" "Nothing! Stand up!" The older boys pulled us to our feet in a line. "You will be led inside the building to a swimming pool with no water in it, and you will recite the Hitlerjugend oath and jump off the diving board." Herr Solomach paused. "If the Führer asks you to jump off a cliff, what would you do?" "Jump!" We were blindfolded, so we did not know which of the 15 of us would be pulled to the diving board first. until, that is, I felt Franz's hand being torn away from mine. "Rainer!" he cried. I suppose at that moment I was thinking of nothing but my mother, warning me to take care of my younger brother. I stood up and yanked off my blindfold and ran like crazy past the boys who were dragging my brother into the building. "Ich gelobe meinem Führer Adolf Hitler Treue!" I cried, streaking past Herr Solemak. "Ich verspreche ihm und den Führern, die er mir bestimmt, jederzeit Achtung und Gehorsam entgegenzubringen. I promise to be faithful to my Führer, Adolf Hitler. I promise to him and to those leaders he has assigned to me to give them my undivided obedience and respect. In the presence of this blood banner, which represents our Führer, I swear to devote all my energies and my strength to the savior of our country, Adolf Hitler. I am willing and ready to give up my life for him. So help me God." And without looking, I leaped. Wrapped in a coarse brown blanket, my clothes still soaking, I told Herr Solenmark that I was jealous of my brother for being chosen first to prove his allegiance and courage. That was why I had cut him in line. There was water in the pool. Not much, but enough. I knew they could not let us all jump and kill ourselves. But since each of us was being brought into the building individually, we could not hear the splash. I knew, however, that Franz would, because he was already at the edge of the pool, and that then he would be able to jump. But Herr Solenmark was less convinced. "It is admirable to love your brother," he said to me, "but not more than your Führer." I was careful the rest of the day to avoid Franz. Instead, I played trapper and Indian with abandon. We split up into platoons based on the color of our armbands, and hunted down the enemy to rip off their armbands. Often these games escalated into full-on brawls. They were meant to toughen us up. Instead of protecting my brother, I ignored him. If he was trampled in the dirt, I wasn't going to pick him up. Herr Solenmark was watching too closely. Franz wound up with a split lip and bruises up and down his left leg, a nasty scrape on his cheek. My mother would hold me accountable, I knew. And still, when we were walking back home at dusk, he bumped his shoulder against mine. I remember the cobblestones on the street were still warm from the heat of the day. There was a rising full moon that night. "Rainer," he said simply. "Danke." The next Sunday we met at an athletic hall and squared off in boxing matches. The idea was to crown a winner from our group of 15 boys. Herr Solenmark had brought Inge and her friends to watch, because he knew that boys would show off even more if girls were present. The winner, he said, would get a special medal. "The Führer says that a physically healthy individual with a sound character is more valuable to the Volkish community than an intellectual weakling," Herr Solenmark said. "Are you that healthy individual?" One part of me was healthy, I knew that much. I could feel it every time I looked at Inge Solmak. Her lips were pink as ribbon candy, and I bet just as sweet. When she sat down on the bleachers, I watched the rise and fall of the buttons on her cardigan. I thought about peeling back those layers to touch skin, how she would be white as milk, soft as... "Hartmann!" Herr Solmak barked, and both Franz and I stood. This surprised him for a moment, and then a smile spread across his face. "Yes, yes. Why not?" he muttered. "Both of you. Into the ring." I looked at Franz, at his narrow shoulders and his tender belly, at the dreams in his eyes that scattered when he realized what Herr Solenmark wanted us to do. I climbed between the ropes and put on the padded helmet, the boxing gloves. As I passed by my brother, I murmured, "Hit me." Inge rang the bell to get us started and then ran back to her girlfriends. One of them pointed at me and she looked up. For one amazing moment, the world stood perfectly still while our eyes met. "Come on," Herr Solenmark urged. The rest of the boys were cheering, and still I circled Franz with my head up. Hit me, I muttered under my breath again. I can't. Schreckling, one of the older boys yelled. Stop acting like a girl. Half-heartedly, I shot out my right fist into my brother's chest. All the air rushed out of his body as he jackknifed. There was a cheer from the boys behind me. Franz looked up at me in fear. Fight back! I yelled at him. I jabbed with my gloves, pulling my punches before I could make contact with his body again. What are you waiting for? Herr Zollemack screamed. So I punched Franz, hard, in the back. He fell to one knee, and there was a gasp from the girls in the bleachers. Then he managed to drag himself upright. He pulled back his left fist and threw a punch at my jaw. I do not know what flipped the switch in me. I suppose it was the fact that I had been struck and was in pain, or maybe the girls watching, whom I wanted to impress. Maybe it was just the bass beat of the older boys egging me on. I started beating Franz in the face, the gut, the kidneys, over and over, rhythmically, until his face was a bloody pulp and spit bubbled out of his mouth as he collapsed on the floor. One of the older boys jumped into the ring and raised my glove, the conquering champion. Herr Zollemack patted me on the back. This, he told the others, is the face of bravery. This is what the future of Germany looks like. Adolf Hitler, Sieg Heil! I returned the salute. So did all the other boys, except my brother. With adrenaline pumping through my veins, I felt invincible. I took on contender after contender, and everyone fell. After years of being punished for letting my temper get the best of me in school, I was being praised for it. No, I was being exalted. That night, Ingus Zollenmark gave me a medal, and 15 minutes later, behind the athletic center, my first real kiss. The next day, my father called on Herr Zollemack. He was very disturbed by Franz's injuries. Your son is gifted, Herr Zollemack explained. Special. Yes, my father responded. Franz has always been an excellent student. I am speaking of Rainer, Herr Zollemack said. Did I know this brutality was wrong? Even that first time when my brother was the victim? I have asked myself 1,000 times, and the answer is always the same. Of course. That day was the hardest, because I could have said no. Every time after that, it became easier, because if I didn't do it again, I would be reminded of that first time I did not say no. Repeat the same actions over and over again, and eventually it will feel right. Eventually, there isn't even any guilt. What I mean to tell you now is that the same truth holds. This could be you, too. You think, never. You think, not I. But at any given moment, we are capable of doing what we least expect. I always knew what I was doing, and to whom I was doing it. I knew very well. Because in those terrible, wonderful moments, I was the person everyone wanted to be.
Alexander had been working for me for 1 week now. We exchanged pleasantries, but mostly he arrived to bake just as I was going to sleep. When I woke up to take the loaves to market, he was untying his white apron. Sometimes, though, he stayed a little later, and I left a little later. He told me that his brother had been born with a caul over his face, that he hadn't had enough air. His parents had died in a plague in Humena, Slovakia. He'd been taking care of Casimir for 10 years now. He explained that Casimir's disorder, as he called it, led him to eat things that he shouldn't. Stones, dirt, twigs, which was why he had to be watched all the time he was awake. He told me of the places he had lived, some with stone castles that pierced the clouds, and others with bustling cities in which there were horseless carriages that moved as if pulled by ghosts. He didn't stay long anywhere, he said, because people felt uneasy around his brother. Alex took to the baking like a natural, something that my father had always believed was the mark of a contented soul.
"You cannot feed others if you're always hungry," he used to tell me.
And when I said this to Alexander, he laughed.
"Your father never met me," he said.
He was always modest in his long-sleeved white shirt, no matter how hot it grew in the kitchen, unlike my father, who used to strip down to his undershirt in the sweltering heat. I complimented him on his rhythm. He moved with grace, as if baking were a dance. Alexander admitted that he had been a baker once before, a lifetime ago. We spoke, too, of the toll of the dead. Alex asked me what the villagers were saying, where the new casualties had been found. Recently, the attacks had come within the perimeter of the village walls, not just on its outskirts. One of the ladies of the evening was found with her head nearly torn from her body in front of the doors of the saloon. The remains of a schoolteacher who had been walking to class were left on the steps of the statue of the village founder. It was as if, some people said, the beast responsible was toying with us. "They're saying," I told him one day, "that maybe it's not an animal." Alex looked over his shoulder. He had the peel thrust deep in the belly of the hearth.
"What do you mean? What else could it be?"
I shrugged. "Some kind of monster?" Instead of laughing, as I expected, Alex sat down beside me. He picked at a chink in the wooden table with his thumb.
"Do you believe that?"
"The only monsters I've ever known were men," I said.
Sage. "Here," I say, handing Joseph a glass of water. He drinks. After nearly 3 hours of talking nonstop, his voice is pebbled, hoarse.
"This is very kind of you."
I don't respond. Joseph looks up at me over the lip of his glass.
"Ah," he says, "you are starting to believe me."
What am I supposed to say? Hearing Joseph talk about his childhood, about the Hitler Youth, with a level of detail that could only have been gleaned from someone who lived it, makes me certain that yes, he is telling me the truth. But there is still a substantial disconnect for me. To see the Joseph this community knows and loves, recounting a time when he was someone completely different. It is as if Mother Teresa confessed that, in her girlhood, she had set cats on fire. It's a little convenient, isn't it, to say that the reason you did something horrible was because someone else told you to? I point out. That doesn't make it any less wrong. No matter how many people are telling you to jump off a bridge, you always have the option to turn around and walk away.
"Why didn't I say no?" Joseph mulls. "Why didn't so many of us? Because we so badly wanted to believe what Hitler told us, that the future would be better than our present."
"At least you had a future," I murmur. "I know of 6 million people who didn't." I feel my stomach turn over as I watch Joseph in his chair, drinking his water as if he had not just told the beginning of a story of abject horror. How could anyone be that vicious to others and not have the after effects bleed out in tears, in nightmares, in tremors? "How can you want to die?" I blurt out. "You say you're religious. Aren't you afraid of being judged?" Joseph shakes his head, lost within himself.
"There was a look in their eyes, sometimes. They weren't dreading the trigger being pulled, even if the gun was already pointed at them. It was as if they ran toward it. I could not fathom this at first. How could you not want to draw breath one more day? How could your own life be such a cheap commodity? But then I started to understand. When your existence is hell, death must be heaven."
My grandmother, had she been one of those who would walk toward the gun? Was that a mark of weakness or of courage?
"I am tired," Joseph sighs. We will talk more on another day, yes?
What I want is to wring information out of him until he is dry and brittle as a bone. I want him to talk until he has blisters on his throat, until his secrets litter the floor around us. But he is an old man. And so instead, I tell him that I will pick him up tomorrow for our grief group. On the car ride home, I call Leo and tell him everything that Joseph just told me. He says when I am done.
That's a start.
A start? That's a ton of information to work with.
Not necessarily, Leo says. After December 1936, all non-Jewish German kids had to join the Hitler Youth. The information he's given you corroborates other things I've heard from suspects, but it doesn't implicate him.
Why not?
Because not all members of the Hitler Youth became SS men.
Well, what have you found out? I ask.
He laughs. It's only been 3 hours since I talked to you in the bathroom, Leo says. Plus, even if I did have detailed information, I couldn't share it with you as a private citizen.
He says he wants me to forgive him before he dies.
Leo whistles, a low, long note. So now you're supposed to be his assassin and his priest? I guess in this case he'd prefer a Jew, even a self-renounced Jew, to a priest. It's a nice macabre touch, Leo says, asking the descendants of the people you killed to let you off the hook before you shuffle off that mortal coil. He hesitates. You can't, you know, for the record.
I know, I say.
There are dozens of reasons why not, starting with the very base fact that I am not the person who was wronged by him. But if you turn the request just slightly, if you let it hit the light of reason from another angle, what Joseph has asked isn't the empty plea of a murderer. It's a dying man's wish. And if I don't grant it, doesn't that make me just as heartless as he is?
When are you talking to him again? Leo asks.
Tomorrow. We're going to grief group.
All right, he says. Call me.
As I hang up, I realize I've missed the turnoff to my house, and more to the point, that I already know where I am headed. The word babka comes from baba, which in Yiddish and Polish means grandmother. I cannot think of a single Hanukkah celebration that didn't include these sweet loaves. It was an unwritten assumption that my mother would buy a turkey the size of a small child, that my sister Pepper would get to mash the potatoes, and that my Nana would bring 3 loaves of the famous babka. Even as a little girl, I remember grating the bittersweet chocolate, terrified I was going to shred my knuckles in the process. Today, I send Daisy home early. I've told her I am here to bake with my grandmother, but really I wanted the privacy. My grandmother butters the first loaf pan as I roll out the dough and brush the edges with an egg wash. Then I sprinkle some of the chocolate filling inside and start to roll the dough tight as a drum. I twist the logs quickly, 5 full turns, and brush the top with egg again.
Yeast, my grandmother says, is a miracle. One little pinch, some water, and look at what happens.
It's not a miracle, it's chemistry, I say. The real miracle is the moment someone looked at fungus for the first time and said, let's see what happens when we cook with it. My grandmother passes me the loaf pan so that I can put the dough inside and press the streusel topping down.
My father, she says, used to send messages to my mother through babka.
I smile at her.
Really?
Yes.
If the filling was apple, it was meant to tell her the bakery had had a sweet day, lots of customers. If it was almond, it meant, I miss you bitterly.
And chocolate?
My Nana laughs. That he was sorry for whatever had gotten him into trouble with her. Needless to say, we ate a lot of chocolate babka.
I wipe my hands on a dishcloth. Nana, I ask, what was he like? What did he do when he wasn't working? Did he ever call you a special nickname or take you somewhere unforgettable?
She purses her lips.
Ach, again with the biography.
I know he died in the war, I say softly. How? She makes a big production of furiously buttering the second loaf pan. Then, finally, she speaks.
Every day, after school, I would come to the bakery and there would be a single roll waiting for me. My father called it a minkele, and he only made one a day. It had the flakiest crumb to it, and a center of chocolate and cinnamon so warm it slid down your throat. And I know he could have sold hundreds, but no, he said that this was special just for me.
He was killed by Nazis, wasn't he? I asked quietly. Nana turns away from me. My father trusted me with the details of his death.
Minka, he would say, when my mother read me the story of Snow White, make a note. I do not want to wind up in a glass case with people looking at me. Or, Minka, make a note. I would like fireworks instead of flowers. Minka, make sure I do not pass in the summertime. Too many flies for the mourners to deal with, don't you think? It was a game to me, a lark, because my father was never going to die. We all knew he was invincible.
She takes one of her canes from where it is hanging on the counter and walks to the kitchen table, sitting heavily on one of the chairs.
My father trusted me with the details of his death, but in the end, I couldn't manage a single one.
I kneel down on the floor in front of her and rest my head in her lap. Her hand, small and bird-like, nests in the crown of my hair. You've held this inside you for so long, I whisper. Wouldn't it be better to talk about it? She touches the scarred side of my face.
Would it?
She asks. I pull back. That's different. I can't pretend this never happened, no matter how much I want to. It's written all over me.
Exactly,
my grandmother says, and she pushes up the sleeve of her sweater to reveal the numbers on her forearm.
I talked once about it, when I was much younger, to my doctor who saw this. He asked if I would come to speak at his wife's class. She was a history professor at a university, she says. The talk went well. I got over my stage fright enough to deliver it without throwing up, anyway. And then the teacher, she asked if there were any questions. A boy stood up. Truth be told, I thought it was a girl. There was so much hair down to here. He stood up and he said, "The Holocaust never happened." I did not know what to do, what to say. I was thinking, how dare you tell me this, when I lived it? How dare you erase my life just like that? I was so upset I could barely see straight. I muttered an apology and I walked right off that stage, out the door, with my hand pressed up against my mouth. I thought if I didn't hold it there, I would start to scream. I went to my car, and I sat inside until I knew what I should have said. History tells us that 6 million Jews disappeared during that war. If there was no Holocaust, where did they go?
She shakes her head.
All of that, and the world didn't learn anything. Look around. There's still ethnic cleansing. There's discrimination. There are young people like that foolish boy in the history class. I thought for sure that the reason I survived was to make certain something like that would never happen again. But you know, I must have been wrong. Because, Sage, it still happens. Every day.
Just because you had some neo-Nazi stand up in that classroom doesn't mean that it's not important for you to tell your story, I say. Tell it to me. She looks at me for a long moment, then silently stands with her cane and walks out of the kitchen. Across the hall in the first-floor study she has converted into a bedroom so that she doesn't have to climb stairs, I hear her moving things around, rifling through drawers. I get up, slip the loaves into the oven. Already they're rising again. My grandmother is sitting on her bed when I come in. The room smells like her, like powder and roses. She is holding a small leather-bound notebook with a cracked binding.
"I was a writer," she says, "a child who believed in fairy tales. Not the silly Disney ones your mother read to you, but the ones with blood and thorns, with girls who knew that love could kill you just as often as it could set you free. I believed in the curses of witches and the madness of werewolves, but I also mistakenly believed that the scariest stories came from imagination, not real life."
She smooths her hand over the cover.
"I started writing this when I was 13. It is what I did when other girls were fixing their hair and trying to flirt with boys. Instead, I would dream up characters and dialogue. I would write a chapter and give it to my best friend, Daria, to read, to see what she thought. We had a plan. I would become a best-selling author, and she would be my editor, and we would move to London and drink slow gin fizzes. Ugh, we didn't even know what slow gin was back then. But this is what I was doing when the war came, and I did not stop."
She hands the volume to me.
"It is not the original, of course. I don't have that anymore, but as soon as I could, I rewrote from memory. I had to."
I open the front cover. Inside, in small, tight cursive, words crawl across the page, packed end to end without any white space, as if that were a luxury. Maybe back then, it was.
"This is my story," my grandmother continues. "It's not the one you're looking for about what happened during the war. That's not nearly as important."
She meets my gaze.
"Because this story, it's the one that kept me alive."
My grandmother, she could have given Stephen King a run for his money. Her story is supernatural, about an upior, the Polish version of a vampire. But what makes it so terrifying is not the monster, who's a known quantity, but the ordinary men, who turn out to be monsters, too. It is as if she knew, even at that young age, that you cannot separate good and evil cleanly, that they are conjoined twins sharing a single heart. If words had flavors, hers would be bitter almonds and coffee grounds. There are times when I'm reading her story that I forget she was the one to write it. That's how good it is. I read the notebook in its entirety, and then I reread it, wondering if I have missed a single word. I try to absorb the story, to the point where it is one I can play back to myself, syllable by syllable, the way my grandmother must have done. I find myself reciting paragraphs when I am showering, washing the dishes, taking out the trash. My grandmother's story is a mystery, but not in the way she intended. I try to pull apart the characters and their dialogue to see the skeleton beneath that must have been her real life. All writers start with a layer of truth, don't they? If not, their stories would be nothing but spools of cotton candy, a fleeting taste wrapped around nothing but air. I read about Anya, the narrator, and her father, and hear my grandmother's voice. I imagine my great-grandfather's face. When she describes the cottage on the outskirts of Łódź, the town square crossed by horse-drawn carts, the forest where Anya would walk with moss sinking beneath her boots, I can smell the peat burning and taste the ash on the bottom of their bread. I can hear the footsteps of children striking the cobblestones as they chase each other, long before they ever had anything or anyone to really run from. I am so engrossed in the story that I am late to pick Joseph up for grief group.
"You slept well?"
he asks, and I tell him yes. As he sits down in the car, I think of the parallels between my grandmother's story, the monster that hunts villagers and kills Anya's father, and the SS, who came into my grandmother's life unannounced and destroyed her family. My grandmother's childhood, those little rolls baked just for her, the long, lazy afternoons when she and her best friend dreamed of their future, even the walls of her family's apartment, unfolds in a parallel line beside Joseph's tale of the Hitler Youth. Yet they are inching closer. I know that they are destined to cross. That makes me hate Joseph right now. I bite my tongue, though, because Joseph does not even know I have a grandmother, much less one who survived the genocide in which he was involved. I'm not sure why I want to guard this information from him. Maybe because he'd be thrilled to hear he was one step closer to finding the right person to forgive him. Maybe because I think he doesn't deserve to know. Maybe because I do not like the idea of my grandmother and someone like Joseph still coexisting in this world.
"You are very quiet today," Joseph muses.
"Just thinking."
"About me?"
"Don't flatter yourself," I say. Because I was late picking Joseph up, we are the last ones to arrive at Grief Group. Stuart immediately approaches, looking for my ever-present bag of baked goods, but I don't have anything today. I was too busy reading my grandmother's journal to bake. "I'm really sorry," I tell him. "I came empty-handed."
"If only Stuart could say the same," Jocelyn murmurs, and I realize he's brought his wife's death mask in again.
Minka, make a note, I think, remembering my great-grandfather. "When I die, no mask, okay?" Marge rings the little bell that always makes me think we are at a yoga class instead of a grief therapy group.
"Shall we get started?"
she asks. I don't know what it is about death that makes it so hard. I suppose it's the one-sided communication. The fact that we never get to ask our loved one if she suffered, if she is happy wherever she is now, if she is somewhere. It's the question mark that comes with death that we can't face, not the period. All of a sudden I realize there is one empty chair. Ethel is missing. I know, even before Marge tells us the news, that her husband Bernie has died.
"It happened on Monday," Mrs. Dombrowski says. "I got the call from Ethel's oldest daughter. Bernie's in a better place now."
I look over at Joseph, who is picking at a thread on his pants, undisturbed.
"Do you think she'll come back here?" Shayla asks.
"Ethel?"
"I hope so," Marge says. "I think if any of you would like to reach out to her, she'd appreciate it."
"I want to send flowers or something," Stuart says. "Bernie had to be a pretty good guy to have a lady like that who took care of him for so long."
"You don't know that," I say slowly, and everyone turns to me, shocked. None of us ever met the man. He could have beat her every day for all we know.
"Sage!" Shayla gasps. "I don't mean to speak ill of the dead," I add quickly, ducking my head. "I imagined Bernie was a great guy who used to go bowling every week and who loaded the dishes into the dishwasher after every meal Ethel cooked. But do you think that only good guys wind up with people like us, left behind? Even Jeffrey Dahmer had a mother."
"That's an interesting point," Marge says. "Do we grieve because the person we lost was such a light in the world, or do we grieve because of who he was to us?"
"Maybe a little of both," Stuart says, his hand running over the contours of his wife's death mask as if he were blind and learning her features for the first time.
"So does that mean we shouldn't feel bad when someone horrible dies?" I ask.
I can feel Joseph's gaze boring into my temple.
"There are definitely people who make this earth better by leaving it," Jocelyn muses. "Bin Laden? Charlie Manson?"
"Hitler?" I say innocently.
"Yeah, I read this book once about a woman who was his personal secretary, and she made him out to be like any other boss, said he used to gossip about the secretary's boyfriends with them," Shayla says.
"If they didn't regret killing people, why should anyone regret when they die?" Stuart says.
"So you think, once a Nazi, always a Nazi? I ask. Beside me, Joseph coughs. I hope there's a special place in hell for people like that, Shayla says, primly. Marge recommends a 5-minute breather. While she talks quietly to Shayla and Stuart, Joseph taps my shoulder. May I speak to you privately? I follow him into the hallway and fold my arms. How dare you? He hisses, stepping so close to me that I retreat a step. What I told you was in confidence. If I wanted the world to know what I used to be, I could have turned myself into the authorities years ago. So you want absolution without any of the punishment, I say. His eyes flash, the blue nearly obliterated by the black of his pupils. You will not speak of this in public anymore, he orders, so loudly that several others in the adjacent room turn toward us. His anger rushes at me, a rogue wave. Even though my scar is on fire, even though I feel as if I have been caught by the teacher passing a note in class, I force myself to look him in the eye. I stand rigid, nothing but breath between us, an empty truce. Don't you ever speak to me that way again, I whisper. I am not one of your victims. Then I turn on my heel and walk away. For just a moment, when Joseph let his own death mask slip, I could see the man he used to be, the one buried beneath the kindly exterior for so many decades, like a weed growing slow beneath pavement, still capable of cracking concrete. I cannot leave Grief Group early without drawing attention to myself, and since I brought Joseph to the meeting, I have to take him home or else face Marge's inquiry. But I don't speak to him, not when we are saying our goodbyes to the others or walking to the parking lot. I am sorry, Joseph says, 5 minutes into our drive. We are stopped at a red light. Well, that's a loaded statement. He continues to stare straight out the window. I mean about what I said to you during the break. I don't respond. I don't want him thinking he is off the hook, and no matter what he said to me, I can't just drop him off at the curb and walk away forever. I owe it to my grandmother. Plus, I promised Leo I wouldn't. If anything, hearing Joseph snap like that makes me even more determined to get enough evidence to have him prosecuted. This is a man, clearly, who at one point in his life could do whatever he wanted without fear of retribution. In a way, by asking me to kill him, he's just doing more of the same. I think it's about time he got what he really deserves. I am nervous, I suppose, Joseph continues. About what? I ask, feeling my scalp prickle. Is he on to me? Does he know that I plan to string him along and then turn him in? That you will listen to all I have to say to you and still not do what I've asked. I face him. With or without me, Joseph, you're going to die. He meets my gaze. Do you know of der ewige Jude? The wandering Jew? The word Jew makes me shudder, as if such a term should not even be allowed to take up passing residence on his lips. I shake my head. It is an old European story. A Jew, Ahasuerus, taunted Jesus as he stopped to rest while carrying his cross. When the Jew told Jesus he should move quicker, Jesus cursed him to walk the earth until the second coming. For hundreds of years there have been sightings of Ahasuerus, who cannot die, no matter how much he wants to. You do realize the great irony here in comparing yourself to a Jew, I say. He shrugs. Say what you will about them, but they thrive, in spite of... He glances at my face. Everything. I should have died several times now. I have had cancer and car accidents. I am the only elderly man I know who has been hospitalized for pneumonia and still survived. You believe what you like, Sage, but I know the reason I am still alive, Like Ahasuerus, every day I am here is another day to relive my mistakes.
The light has turned green, and there are cars behind me honking, but I haven't put my foot on the accelerator. Joseph seems to retreat into himself, lost in thought.
Herr Solemach, from the Hitlerjugend, used to tell us Jews were like weeds. Pull out one, and two more grow in their place.
I press down on the gas, and we jolt forward. I'm disgusted with Joseph for being exactly who he professed to be. I'm disgusted with myself for not believing him at first, for being fooled into thinking that this man was a grandfatherly good Samaritan, like everyone else in this town.
But I used to think, Joseph says quietly, that there are some weeds that are just as beautiful as flowers.
There was something behind me. It was a sixth sense, a chill on the back of my neck. I had turned around a dozen times since entering the woods, but only saw the bare trees standing like sentries. Still, my heart was racing. I walked a little faster toward the cottage, clutching my bread basket, wondering if I was close enough for Alex to hear me if I screamed. Then I heard it, the crunch of a twig, a break in the surface of the snow. I could run. If I ran, whatever was behind me would chase me. Once again, I picked up my pace. Tears leaked from the corners of my eyes, and I blinked them back. Abruptly, I ducked behind a tree wide enough to conceal me. I held my breath, counting as the footfalls came closer. A doe walked into the clearing, swiveling its head to stare at me before nibbling at the bark of a birch a few feet away. Relief turned my legs to jelly. I leaned against the trunk of the tree, still trembling. This was what happened when you let the idle prattle of the villagers seep into your mind like poison. You saw shadows when there were none. You heard a mouse and imagined a lion. Shaking my head at my own stupidity, I stepped away from the tree and started toward home again. It attacked me from behind, covering my head with something hot and dank, some sort of fabric or sack that kept me blind. I was pinned by my wrists, with weight on the small of my back so I couldn't stand up. My face was shoved into the ground. I tried to yell, but whatever was behind me pushed my head down so that my mouth filled with snow instead. I felt heat and blades and claws and teeth. Oh, the teeth!